This episode discusses domestic violence and substance and alcohol use.
Edit audio.
In the last bonus episode of the Springfield 3.
I first met Robert Cox when I was in middle school. He was my mom's boyfriend and then fiance.
We heard from a woman who we called Jennifer. Her mother dated Robert Craig Cox when she was a teenager.
I remember arguing with her on the way to the courthouse because she said, Bob says we went to church. You know, he wants me to say we were at church. And we were like, Mom, we don't go to church. That just isn't true. She's like, I know. I don't know what to do. She was scared.
We also heard about a DM that I received from a woman named Shelley. She told me that she was picked up on the side of the road in Springfield, Missouri, when she was just 14 years old. After watching a true crime show that featured the three missing women case, she said that she recognized this man as Robert Craig Cox. After I read this message from Shelley, I thought back to Jennifer, who told me that Robert Craig Cox would drive them to Whitewater in his pickup truck.
He used to, on weekends, take me and my friends up to Whitewater in the back of his pickup truck. You know, monsters rarely seem capable of doing what they do. People all the time say, God, he was so nice. He lived right next door. So I say, gosh, but it's Bob. He couldn't have done that. The guy took us to Whitewater and was silly, but I guess you never know.
But this episode isn't about him. In this episode, I was finally able to speak with Bart Streeter.
My name is Bart Streeter. I am the son of Cheryl Levitt and the brother of Suzanne Streeter.
I'm your host, Ann Roderick Jones, and this is a bonus episode of the Springfield 3, a podcast about the disappearance of three women who forever changed a small Missouri town and the people in it. Bart is not in the habit of doing interviews with the media. Since the disappearance of his mother and sister, he tells me that different media outlets have done everything from getting the age of his sister wrong to spelling his mother's name incorrectly to completely sensationalizing incidents that occurred in the home. Bart grew up in Washington State with his mother and sister.
My mother, sister, and I were primarily the family. My father wasn't around very often. And when he was, he'd come in, be there for a month or two, and then he'd be gone again. So it was just the three of us. And it was wonderful.
Bart gives me some context on his mother and her marriages. He tells me that Cheryl was married three times, to his father, a man named Fred, and then Don Streeter. She wasn't someone who dated or had men coming in and out of the house. She had three relationships that all resulted in marriage. Bart tells me that his father wasn't around often. They divorced around the time Susie was born, and that he loved Fred and Don, despite the marriages not working out. Bart, Susie, Cheryl, and her husband Don all moved to Springfield in 1981 when he was 16 years old and Susie was 8.
When we first moved to Springfield, we rented a house, and the first thing that as a family we noticed was everything was so much slower than where we came from. We all talked way too fast. We wanted things done very quickly. We were looking to buy a house, or my parents were looking to buy a house, and it was difficult for us. There was this culture shock in the United States, and we had to settle in. And I remember having conversations about that where we have to change our approach to life. And at 16 years old, I didn't want to. I wanted the speed of life and culture around me to continue the way it was. And it's a beautiful town. It's not as beautiful as the Pacific Northwest, in my opinion. I never really felt comfortable in Springfield. And that's been a lifetime, even before the kidnappings of my mother and sister and Stacy. I just didn't feel comfortable there. There was something about Springfield that just didn't work for me. And it may have been because of the Bible Belt.
Bart's not wrong about the Ozarks being the Bible Belt. But I didn't know anything else growing up. My grandparents owned a Christian bookstore on Commercial Street. I attended Southern Baptist Church, where you couldn't dance or drink alcohol. When I'm back home and I meet someone new, I'm almost always asked what church I attend. In the Ozarks, religion is the backbone of the community. But back to the Streeter family. So they were all living in Springfield, where Cheryl goes on to work at New Attitudes Hair Salon.
I never knew my mother to be anything but a cosmetologist. She was 19 years old when she had me, so her profession, you know, her career goal was, I don't know if it was different than that. But she worked my entire life, especially when I was younger, because my father was so unreliable in the relationship, she provided everything. And we really never wanted for anything because my mother worked 12, 13, 14-hour days, 6 days a week. I'd moved to Springfield in September of 19, moved back to Springfield in September of 1991. We had lived together from September until about January or February of 1992. And then Susie and I had gone and gotten our own house, and my mom had purchased the house on Del Mar. And she had shown us the house on Del Mar. Around Christmas time, she took us to the house and made arrangements with the owner, and we went and saw the house. And it was this small little bungalow-style house. And if you know my mother, I could just see what she was going to do with the house.
It was this house, the one on Del Mar, that they just moved into, where Susie and Cheryl and Stacy likely disappeared from. Bart talks to me about his mother, what she was like, and her reputation after the night of the disappearance.
It was like we were growing up together, because Mom had me when she was 19 years old. My mother had a form of raising me that I think some people haven't never heard of. But most of it was hands off. She didn't force her belief systems on me. She didn't force me to go to church. She did not interfere in a lot of things. But there was a lot of responsibility. I did the chores in the house. Wasn't always happy about it, and I didn't always want to do the chores, but I vacuumed and I did the dishes and I took the trash out every single day. I look back on it and I'm so grateful for it because I can take care of myself. My mother taught me how to take care of myself. I do my own laundry. I do everything. I know how to set a goal and move forward and accomplish it because of her example. So to see her reputation be besmirched so early in the investigation was so deeply frustrating. I've thought about this many times. If my sister would have been at somebody's house and she would have been kidnapped with the mother and the daughter and my mother, the focus would have been on them. And I think that was part of it. Part of it is we didn't fit into the mold of Springfield. And there is a Christian mold in Springfield. It's not that we were ever anti-religious. We just didn't go to church. We didn't cultivate that community because my mother was an incredibly private person. Not that she didn't socialize and didn't want to socialize. I'm sure she knew the neighbors. Those types of things were at the core of who she was, but she didn't really fit into that Christian mold. And I don't think people who don't live in the Bible Belt understand how deeply that's ingrained in their communities.
I wanted to talk to Bart about the night that his mother and sister and Stacy disappeared. I'm hoping to get some sort of timeline, and I also want to know where he was, what he was doing, and his reaction, all in his own words.
My mother and sister and Stacy were kidnapped. The estimated timeline is between when they left the last party, graduation evening, and 7, 8, 9 o'clock in the morning. That was Saturday into Sunday. I went to work Monday morning like I always did and stopped at Get and Go and got my coffee and my donut from Daylight Donuts. And I was working for a small land surveying company. I was a crew chief and we were doing a lot of mortgage surveys at the time. And I could do 3 or 4 a day. Got my guys together, got the truck, went out and did the mortgage surveys. It was a beautiful morning. There was really nothing odd about it. I was a little hungover because I was still pretty young and I enjoyed my parties on the weekends. And by 10, 11 o'clock in the morning, I was doing good. Had drank enough Gatorade and feeling good. We'd gone back to the office and when they got back to the office, I picked up my other two surveys, dropped the other two we'd concluded off to the draftsperson, and went to pick up my other two for the day. And there was a notice in my inbox. It was just a message, you know, the little message pads to call the Springfield Police Department. And I looked at it kind of dubious because I hadn't finished community service on another alcohol-related charge that I had gotten about 6 months earlier. As I say, I looked at it kind of dubiously, and I thought, I don't want to call the Springfield Police Department. I don't want to deal with this right now. But something hit me that I needed to call. So I called the number, and a lady answered. She asked me if I had seen my mother and sister. And I said, I had not seen or spoken to my mother and sister in about 3 months. And then she said, well, it was graduation weekend. And I thought, wow, I wasn't invited to graduation. And then I thought, well, my grandfather and aunt, family members, should probably come in from Washington State. And they had gone someplace. So I said that my grandfather or aunt may have come in from out of town, and they may be in Branson or someplace celebrate, you know, in some type of form of family celebration. And she said, well, we don't think that's what's happened. Could you come down to the police station? And I said, absolutely. And I dropped everything I was doing, quickly stuck my head in the door of my boss and told him I would be leaving. And I would explain it later. And I drove to the police station. And when I walked in the door, the receptionist stood up. She said, go through the small swinging door, get on the elevator, go to the second or third floor to the special crimes unit. And I did that. And when I got in the elevator, I realized I didn't even introduce myself. How did this person know who I was? And then kind of a dread hit me. This isn't going to be good. And I got upstairs and I took a right, took another right, and there was a door that said, and I can't remember to this day if it was actually a plaque that said Special Crimes Unit. In my memory, it was just a little piece of paper that said Special Crimes Unit taped to the frame of the door. And there was a desk outside the door, and there was nobody at the desk, but there was a cup of coffee or something there. And I said, okay, somebody's supposed to be staged here, but they're not here. And I just walked in. And when I looked to the right, it was a pretty long room, and there was full of people at desks, and they were obviously detectives and support. And at the end of the room, there was a big desk, like a meeting desk, with a bunch of people around it, and there was butcher paper on the wall. And each one of those sheets of butcher paper had our lives on them. One of them was titled Cheryl Levitt. One was titled Susie Streeter. One was titled Stacy McCall. And I didn't know who Stacy McCall was. And one of them was me. And I think there was one with my father. And I walked towards the meeting table and stopped and took in the entire situation and said in a normal voice, what the hell is going on here? And as I said it, it almost sounded like I was yelling it in my mind. Because it was confusing and it was shocking. And from there, I kind of went into a military mode with a heightened state of awareness. You're trying, at that point, you're trying so hard to understand what you're being told, but it didn't make sense, especially when you know my mother on the level that I know my mother. This is the most responsible person I've ever met. And at that point, David Asher walked up to me, Detective David Asher. He was the person that I spoke to for probably the next 45 to 60 days. And that was the beginning of the nightmare of a hell that just hasn't ended for 29 years.
What was your role in this? I know we talked about you going to the police station. Were you readily available and open to the police department for questioning, for anything that they needed?
Absolutely, 100%. I had never been that open in my entire life. There was nothing off limits with me.
When reading about this case, there are numerous reports that Cheryl was talking to someone on the phone the night of the disappearance around 11 p.m. that evening. It's reported that she was painting a dresser, but I could never find out exactly who she was talking to.
So we know that
You know, you talking about your mom fixing up her homes. We know that your mom, or maybe you can tell me, if your mom was refurbishing a dresser that evening.
Oh, absolutely. It makes perfect sense. She was talking to her best friend, a woman that I have known my entire life, named Val. And for Val to say that my mother was refurbishing a dresser makes absolute sense. That's what my mother did.
Did Val say that anything seemed wrong with your mother during that time?
I've never spoken to Val about that. In fact, I only saw Val one time in the last 29 years. And it's strange. Generally, when it comes to my family, we haven't discussed this case. And I would consider Val family. It's strange.
Why is that?
Why is that? I don't know. I really, really don't know. There's things that should have been discussed many, many, many times.
Maybe for Bart and his family, some things are just too close to talk about. Bart said that he was only in the Delmar house twice. The first time was prior to moving in, when his mother was in the process of possibly buying the house. They went out to a nice dinner, and Cheryl took her kids by to see the house. The second time was after the disappearance.
So I went to the house, met my uncle, and we opened up the door and I went inside. The first thing I noticed was there was a notebook on the couch table. And I picked it up and I flipped through it, and there was hundreds of people's names in it. And it was a log, because they had created the command center at my mother's house. Okay? I come to find out later that they had staged things in the house, because all the people that went into the house between 7 o'clock Sunday morning and the time the police came and wrangled everybody out of the house, locked the door and put a note on the door, there had been about 18 people in and out of that house. When the police report was made, I think there was fewer, but there had been 18 people, different people, in and out of my mother's house. The crime scene had been completely 100% tainted. Things had been cleaned and arranged, and the purses were moved to the dining room table. And so, because they didn't know. That is just a forgiven thing. They can spin it to be forgiven. But it would have been me that went into the house. Would they have spun it a different way? Then I noticed the fingerprint dust. And I thought, oh my God, my mom would be just horrified. And it made me sad that they'd left the house with all the fingerprint dust everywhere. Then I walked into the kitchen and opened up the refrigerator. And my sister's graduation cake was sitting there. And I lost it. And I left. And I never went back.
Bart was a suspect in the disappearance of his mother, sister, and Stacy. And this has followed him for his entire life. But when he talks to me, he doesn't shy away from telling me about the times he's been in trouble with the law over the years.
The cycle was, mom would help me out. Let me get back on my feet again. I would hand her so much money every payday, and she had an envelope in the same dresser we were talking about earlier, you know, a big manila envelope, and she would put money in there for me. And then after 2 or 3 months, I'd be on my way. I'd go, okay, new adventure. Let's go someplace else. But the cycle was, I would start drinking. And I knew I wasn't supposed to drink in my mom's house. And I would do it anyway. And it was disrespectful, and I would do it. So the periods of time that I would be in town weren't very long. And there weren't fights. There weren't arguments. It was, you know, my mother was a very matter-of-fact person. And she would come to me and she would say, you know the people you need to be around. And she was talking about AA.
He talks openly about his alcohol abuse, but to put it mildly, it seems as if Bart doesn't have a whole lot of faith in people because of this disappearance, a devastating occurrence that has set the pace for his entire life.
My mother wasn't always proud of the things I've done because I'm a drinker. I'm a binge drinker. I don't daily drink, but my mother had dealt with enough alcohol in her life, and she dealt with enough people who struggle with it. So she had these expectations that were nothing but pure and good for my life. But I wasn't living up to them, and I wasn't going to. And people have a hard time with me being so forthcoming about these types of things. I don't need to hide from the reality because the reality, this is my reality. And if I hide from it, it doesn't make any sense. People need to know because there's been so much speculation and so much misinformation and so many half-truths.
I told you earlier that Bart doesn't do a lot of interviews. He tells me that he's been portrayed in a negative light, most recently on an episode of People Investigates. This particular show came out right as I was writing this podcast. I watched it at the time, and then I rewatched it after speaking to Bart.
And People Magazine was an example of that, where one of the producers talked to me for quite a while, and I was considering doing the show, and then when I decided not to do the show, they recreated something that never happened. You know, I never stumbled around drinking in front of my mother's house, throw a bottle of the house and banged on the door while my mother peeked out the door in terror. I never hit my sister.
Bart's speaking about a part of the show where an actor portrays him and his family and shows him hitting his sister, Susie. He tells me that he didn't hit his sister, but someone had.
My sister and I did have an argument. That argument wasn't even about the level of the stereo. The argument was, she told me to turn it down. I told her no, that I was partying. And she walked up behind me and reached over my shoulder and turned out the volume. And in the process of doing that, she knocked over this little clown lamp that we had bought together because we both love to go flea markets and little antique stores and stuff like that. We just decorated our house together. My sister and I bought everything that was in our home. And I jumped up and turned around and instantly saw the look in her eyes and realized my sister's been abused before.
Throughout this entire investigation, there seems to be a huge focus on the fact that she dated grave robbers, but not a whole lot of focus on an abusive relationship. I wanted to do some digging to confirm Bart's statement. According to a Newsleader article from June 10, 1992, Mike Kovacs, then age 17, is quoted in this article saying that he and Susie went out for about 2 years, breaking up the previous September. He said that they had fought several times and went on to say, quote, "Sure, we hit each other before when we were first going out, back when we were 15, unquote. He went on to say that after the disappearance, he was worried about her and didn't know what to do. Susie Streeter was granted a 10-day restraining order against Mike Kovacs in which he was not allowed to, quote, abuse, threaten to abuse, molest, or disturb the peace of the perpetrator, unquote. In addition, he was not allowed to enter the home, school, or workplace. It's reported by friends that Streeter was frightened of Kovacs and had coworkers walk her to her car at night. Kovacs volunteered for a polygraph test after the disappearance, which he passed. The same article states that Mike said he was alone that night and in the early morning hours of the disappearance, but that he did not have anyone to verify this information for him. It appears that Mike Kovacs was eliminated early as a suspect in this case.
And she told me he'd been abusive. It was known by the police department. The restraining order was obviously known by the police department. See, there's so many different avenues that they haven't made public. There's people that their privacy and their reputations have been protected. Completely 100% protected. And then there's not. And the bias that I see now that has happened from day one should be obvious to all. But how can it be when these other things aren't discussed?
So did the Springfield Police Department choose to look into certain suspects more than others? I want to know if Bart has any theories about who could have done this. So far, he's been incredibly forthcoming in our interviews and chats in between. I think that if he had an opinion on who did this, he'd share it with me.
It's a very hard question for me because I can't imagine anybody wanting to hurt my family. But I am also a realist and I don't know, you know, 6 degrees of separation. Who were they around? What was going on in their lives? That's the police's job to do that. And what I've been able to gather from all of this is there's direct lines to people that are those types of people, that those types of people that would murder somebody. And there's been so many theories put forth, and some of them are just ridiculous, and others are plausible, but I don't have enough information, and I'm that type of person. I need information to be able to make a rational, sound assessment of a situation. And if I'm not given that information, then I'm still sitting in a place of ambiguity even when it comes to that.
Bart told me that for a long time, he was convinced that Robert Craig Cox had committed this crime. But these days, he no longer has an answer.
Robert Cox, I was convinced Robert Cox had committed this crime to the point where I would say things where people would say, well, he knows. Bart must know because he's said he knows. Well, no, I was just convinced because I needed somebody to put the villain label on. I needed the villain. And I've said this before. There was a time that I would have put a bullet in someone's head over this. There's absolutely a time.
Bart now lives in Portland, Oregon. He went back to the Pacific Northwest, and he's still looking for his mom and sister.
What I would like to know is, what would you say to your mom and sister if you could say something to them right now?
I love you. I miss you every single day. And I apologize for being so neglectful. How do you communicate 29 years? You can't. I think about my mother and sister hundreds of times a day. I'll hear a Neil Diamond song, and the tears just start flowing. My mother was an incredible dancer, and people don't know that about her. You know, she was raised in the 40s and 50s. So Bobby socks and poodle skirts and 50s music. And when I was young, we would dance. We would do the twist, and the joy that came out of my mother was deep inside her. And it was infectious. And I used to dance that way with my sister. And mom wouldn't join in much when Susie and I would dance. But I was never self-conscious. You know how boys are. They go out on the dance floor and they're so self-conscious. But with my mother, never. And I'm sorry that she never got to spend time with her grandchildren.
In the next episode of the Springfield 3,
something's really screwy and has been from the very beginning with the Springfield Police Department. Accountability and transparency is what needs to happen. And that's what the community and everybody else needs to force them to do.
The Springfield 3 is an Edit Audio original production created in collaboration with Ann Roderick Jones. The series is written, researched, and hosted by Ann Roderick Jones. It was produced and edited by Ali Sirwa, with executive producing from Steph Colburn, Sophie Shin, and with lots of help from the rest of the amazing Edit Audio team. Theme music was written by Patrick Rindle and Ali Sirwa, and was produced by Patrick Rindle at Studio Dolly. And thank you to all of those who reached out to us and shared their stories after this podcast came out. We really appreciate the interest and support. If you have any information about this case, please contact the Springfield Police Department or email us at hello@editaud.io.